today we have another amazing plantsman with us. Bill Adams owns and operates Sunscape's Rare Plant Nursery, which is a small specialty nursery growing choice rock garden and hardy native and unusual dryland plants from around the world. So the plants that he has will tie in nicely to some of the other talks that we've had. I know Mike Bone and Bob Nold specifically mentioned that phrase, dryland gardening, dryland plants. So that's one reason I chose Bill to speak to us today as a nice continuation of the series. Bill is very involved in his own neck of the woods in Pueblo, Colorado, and leads the kind of the movement there. He's at the forefront of water-wise landscaping for the city and street plantings. And he's been instrumental in designing, planting, and maintaining a number of water-wise gardens there, as well as maintaining his own amazing nursery with really great, well-adapted plants for our climate. So without further ado, I want to welcome Bill Adams to join us on the call today. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks, Ava.
How are you today?
I'm good.
Great. Well, one thing I just forgot to mention to everyone is that Bill does have an incredible slideshow prepared for us, and you got the link in the email yesterday for how to find that slideshow. And if you missed that email somehow, it is the same email you've used in the past for any of the speakers to find their slideshow. So you'll want to bring that up now while I ask Bill some basic questions about how he got started gardening and kind of who he is as a gardener. So, Bill, will you tell us where and how you first started gardening?
Well, I've always been interested in the natural world, and so as a hobby, when I was younger, I was involved with plants. I had a cactus collection, and I'm a amateur mycologist, so I'm out and about in the landscape. And in college, I majored in biology because that was something that was interesting, and therefore it's easier. But when I got out of college, I ended up in the banking business, so I was a banker for 20 years. And when I got out of the banking business, I got back in the plant business.
Perfect. That sounds, as a gardener myself and someone who wouldn't really want to be working in a bank, it sounds like it was probably a welcome sort of homecoming for you to return to.
Well, banking makes a lousy hobby.
Yeah, I might agree with that from my own biases. So why don't you tell us, your talk today is sort of focused on or even entirely focused on rock gardening. So will you tell us how you first got engaged with rock gardening specifically?
Well, this is an easy question to answer because I was, back in 1980, I was at the, went up to the Botanic Gardens, and there is a, has been a Mother's Day plant sale for many, many years. And so I went up to go to the plant sale, and my wife and I were down in the rock garden, and I specifically remember seeing a little pumila iris, and pumila iris are little bitty bearded iris that are only maybe 3-4 inches tall. And I remember being particularly taken because my experience with irises up to that point were all big, tall things. I had no idea that there were little bitty iris. And as we were walking around, we ran into Panayoti Kelladis, who at the time was the curator of the Rock Alpine Garden. And Panayoti gave a talk in the series last month, so a lot of you are familiar with him. And He, of course, is very enthusiastic about rock gardening. And what I have done since then really is primarily due to him. So that's essentially how I became a rock gardener and ultimately a nurseryman.
Well, I can very easily see how that could have happened, because Pan AOT is very charismatic and his enthusiasm for gardening is very contagious, I would say. So that makes perfect sense. And I understand you two continue to be colleagues and good friends to this day.
We've known each other longer than I like to think about now.
You don't have to tell us.
1980 seems like not too long ago, but it is a long time ago now.
Gets longer ago every year.
Yes.
So I assume, and you tell me because I really don't know, but I would assume that you probably rock garden in your own home space there as well as other kinds of gardens. Is that true?
I do, and most of what I do at my home is rock gardening, and because I'm a grower, and a lot of things I grow from seed, the rock gardens are my seed bank. A lot of seed comes from the garden, so I have gardens because I enjoy having them, and two, I have them because they're a source for seed.
Yeah.
And we're going to look at a few pictures of my garden at the beginning of the PowerPoint presentation.
Great. Well, I'll try to clip us along so we can get there, because I know everyone is probably anxious to get seeing your beautiful slides. I know I am. But real quick first, tell us your elevation where you garden and what your native soil is like, please.
Pueblo is about 4,800 feet. We're about 30 miles from east of the Wet Mountains. Those are the closest mountains to us. Our precipitation, we get a little less than 12 inches a year, and that's distributed more or less an inch a month. We get less per month in the winter, more in some of the summer months, but it is relatively dry. Our summer temperatures are routinely in the 90s in the summer, occasionally some temperatures in the into the low hundreds. Winters, cold, dry, long periods below freezing, some periods below zero. So it's a relatively severe climate, and it's we live in a steppe climate, and I'll discuss a little bit of that later.
Great. And is your soil clayey or more sandy?
It depends. If you're lucky and you live on the south side of town like I do, I have nice sandy loam. On some parts of town, you have bentonite clay with rivers of sand in between. So there's some very difficult places to garden in Pueblo, but not quite as difficult for me.
Great. Okay, well, I think that helps for us to place you kind of as a gardener and your conditions within the scheme of the Interior West. So thank you for sharing that with us. And let's go ahead and turn it over to you now, Bill, and get on your slideshow.
Okay, thanks. Well, it's nice to have you all with us today. And what I'm going to do is basically talk to you about rock gardening and rock garden plants. And the talk is plants from near and far. And what I'm going to do is take you on a little tour to a number of places around the world where there are plants that we use in our gardens here in the Interior West that are successful. And the first thing I'll do is to show you just a few pictures of my rock garden. And if you go to the next image, These pictures were taken around the middle of May, and my rock garden is relatively small. It's 30 feet by 40 feet, roughly. But as you can see, if you're a rock gardener, that in a relatively small place, you can plant a lot of different plants. The plants are relatively small, and if you're a plant nut and you enjoy plants, this is a really good gardening style for you. If you're not that interested in plants and you just want something pretty, rock gardening is more work than you might want. But if you really enjoy plants, you don't notice the work in your garden. And so if you go to the next image, it's just another view of the garden. Some of the plants that we see in here, I'm going to touch on as we get further on in the presentation. The next image is another view showing some cacti mixed in with perennial. Everything in this garden that you'll see is perennial. Next image, just some more plants. Very showy. Spring, of course, is the easier season. There's a lot of small rock garden plants that bloom in the spring. Summer is a little more challenging to come up with plants that are going to be showy. And because most perennials bloom for a relatively short period of time, the way you get color in your garden all the time is to have lots of plants that bloom at different times during the year, so that at any particular time of the year, something will be blooming. So the garden is constantly changing. And if you have a right selection of plants, you always have some color.
Bill, these are beautiful.
And
I love the...
You go to the next...
Just real quick, let me...
What's that?
Let me just interrupt real quick. I'm sorry. Sometimes I think people can get a little lost if they have to walk away for a moment from the presentation. So if you could tell us the number of the slide you're on periodically, I think that would help. Do you see it down in the bottom?
I do. We're on number 6 now.
Thank you.
So we can keep everybody up to date.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, so if we move on, we're first going to look at Europe and Asia, some parts of the old world where it's very good to look for plants. And the next image shows you a map of the old world, and in green you see the western and the eastern steppe. And as I mentioned earlier, and as you heard from Paniotti last month, steppe climate is an area of primarily grassland and shrubs where there's not enough moisture to support trees, but it's not as dry as a desert. And those of us in Colorado who live along the Front Range, and a lot of people in the interior west, live in steppe climate. That climate is characterized generally by cold, dry winters, hot, dry summers. So if you were going to look in other parts of the world for plants that would be useful to use in the interior west, it makes sense to look in areas that are like where we live. You can always do special things and struggle to grow plants that don't grow in a climate like the interior west. And a lot of people always want to do that. You always want to grow something somebody tells you can't grow. But the easiest way to grow plants is to pick plants that are better adapted to the region where we live. So when you look at the world, you start looking for places with steppe climate or something similar to steppe climate. So we're going to look, if we go to the next image, we're going to look at Europe first. And there are a couple of areas where routinely you find plants from this part of the world. And the next image shows you the Balkans. And you're going to see some plants from Croatia and Hungary. Dalmatia is an area that runs on the south from Albania up toward Croatia along the eastern side of the Adriatic Sea. And this part, this mountainous range in the Balkans have produced a lot of really nice plants for rock gardens. And this first plant that you're looking at is Degenia vilobetica. And I will apologize to those who are not familiar with Latin binomial nomenclature, but many of these plants either don't have common names or I don't know what they are. But one thing you can be assured of is that no matter the name, the plant will stay the same. So this is a very nice little plant. It has nice gray foliage. In this case, there's so many flowers you hardly see the foliage. But this is an endemic to the Velebit Mountains in Croatia. And it's so highly regarded in Croatia that the plant is depicted on the back of one of the Croatian coins, monetary coins. If you were to go out in my garden right now, it would be blooming out there. So it's an early spring bloomer. The next plant that you're looking at is a Daphne. And there are Daphnes are evergreen aromatic shrubs. They occur in lots of areas in the Old World. This particular Daphne niorum variety, Puchta, was found in Hungary. And the Daphnes in my garden now are just getting toward finishing flowering. They're a little earlier this year because it was a warmer year. But the flowers are very aromatic. And in the interior west, we're a little short of nice evergreen shrubs. There are a lot of exotic evergreen shrubs that can be grown in areas that are not as severe as our climate. So, but a lot of them fail here. So Daphnes are just terrific little shrubs. They're unfortunately a little hard to find. When you find them, they generally are comparatively expensive, but they're certainly worth your while trying to obtain them. And you're better to buy little plants than big plants. Big plants don't establish as well, and they're much more expensive. So if you have an opportunity to get a Daphne, buy a small one and let it grow.
Bill, I've wondered why they are hard to find and expensive.
Well, Daphnes they're difficult to find, and they're expensive for two reasons. One, you need to do them from cuttings. And there is a little more laborious process involved in getting the cuttings to root. And second, Daphnes tend not to like being in pots. So if you're a nursery person, mm-hmm. and you're buying Daphnes that are a little expensive to begin with, and you have trouble keeping them alive in the nursery before you can sell them, all of a sudden you're not very interested in carrying Daphnes.
Yeah.
So I think that's mostly why you don't see them.
Okay, thanks.
And they're better available probably from mail-order nurseries, people who are in the business of raising exotic plants.
Great.
But terrific plants. Okay, this next plant, this is one of my favorites, and this is a plant that grows in the Dalmatian area that I explained to you before. Yeah, and this is Moltkia petraea. So it's a borage. Blooms early to mid-summer. Terrific blue flowers. It's not readily available. It's generally done from seed, and the seed does not always germinate very well. I've seen pictures in Nature of this plant that get maybe 2-3 feet across and a foot high. In my garden, the plants are still relatively small. They grow slowly. They may get bigger over time, I don't know. But a terrific plant if you have an opportunity to get Moltkia petraea, I would recommend it. It is very drought tolerant. Okay, next, you're looking at another Daphne. This is Daphne jasminia. Jasminia grows in Greece. It's a little different than some of the other small Daphnes in that it doesn't start blooming until you get into latter part of the early summer. But it's a little tiny mini shrub. Doesn't generally get more than about 4 inches tall, maybe, and grows very slowly. And these little white flowers appear throughout most of the summer and into fall. Not readily available because it has such short little branches that I think it's more difficult to propagate. But another really great Daphne. Okay, next we're going to look at the Caucasus. This is another mountainous area that has produced a lot of plants that translate very well into our climate. And the first picture I'm going to show you is a Draba. And there are lots of Drabas. They're little, generally alpine plants, bloom very early in the spring. I have some that are just finishing blooming now. This is Draba polytrica that was in bloom probably a month ago and is now through blooming. And this is in one of my troughs. And those of you who don't know what a trough is just a fancy name for a container. And if you're growing little bitty plants that would get lost in a big garden, one of the ways to appreciate them is to put them in a container of some sort. And you can build a little sort of mini rock garden in that container. And also there are some plants that don't grow well in the open garden. There's not enough drainage in the soil or whatever the conditions may be, but there's some plants are most successfully grown in a container. This Draba polytrica is one that has fuzzy leaves, and most of the Drabas with fuzzy leaves are challenging to grow. This one is the easiest to grow. Okay.
Bill, can I ask
now, Sempervivums, yeah?
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
When you were talking about the, I'm blanking on the name, the fragrant shrub, I'm spacing it right now.
Draba, or a Daphne?
Daphne, yeah. You were saying how that one and then the blue one before it were not readily available. Now, does that include from you too, or are these plants you're showing us all ones that you carry at your nursery?
Generally, the plants that I'm showing are plants that that I sell, although from year to year, you never know for sure if you'll have them. I do sell some of the small Daphnes, and this year I do have Moltkia petraea, which I've never had in enough quantity to sell to anybody, but fortunately this year I do. So either I'm getting smarter or the seed's getting better.
Great. Okay, I appreciate that because I know I'm kind of feeling like a hesitancy almost to fall in love with these plants if I know I'm not going to be able to find them anywhere. And so I imagine it's like that for some of our listeners too and just want to kind of gauge that, like, are we ever going to be able to find them anywhere? So.
Well, sometimes if you're a plant nut person like I am and you have a really great picture of a really rare, strange plant, you can't resist showing it to people.
Yeah.
And I have at times been received some criticism from people who say, well, you show this really great plant, but now you tell me I can't find it. I say, well, that's the brakes on that one. But I try not to show too many that you can't find, but every once in a while one will sneak in.
Okay.
And this, the plant that we're looking at now, if any of you have lost, we're up to image 17 now. This is a sempervivum-like plant. This is a Jova barba. It's Jova barba hufelii Orion. And there are lots and lots of sempervivums and sempervivum-like plants. And in many cases, they get sort of short shrift because people figure they're just common, and therefore you should have something that's not quite so common for your garden. But sempervivums and plants like this are very useful in the garden for a wide variety of reasons. So you can spend hours and days and weeks and years trying to get some exotic androsaceae or something to grow, and if you're successful, you end up with a clump of rosettes that look like a sempervivum. So why not use sempervivums to begin with? Hufelii are different in that they don't produce chicks. They don't produce little offsets. The rosettes split in half. And in order to propagate them, you have to cut the rosettes apart. And therefore, you don't see them out in the market as much because they're more difficult to produce. But they also, because they don't produce offsets, they don't expand quite as rapidly. So if you need a sempervivum-type plant that's going to occupy less space, Hufelii are good for that purpose. And they also will take more sun than sempervivums. And if you live in a really hot climate and you put sempervivums in full sun, they don't die, but they just sort of shrivel up and wait for it to get cooler because they really are alpine plants. So a Hufelii is a nice alternative. Okay. This is a really terrific plant. This is also from the Caucasus. This is Edrianthus pumilio. It's a little cushion plant. Doesn't get more than a couple inches high at most. It is an alpine plant, not difficult to grow, provided that you don't bake it. It wants to be on a east or northeast exposure and frequently in a crevice of some sort. If you give it that kind of treatment, it's not difficult to grow. It's a Campanula family plant. But it has sessile, gorgeous blue flowers. And this is at times offered in nurseries, but it's one of my very favorite plants from the Caucasus. Okay, we're going to move on to another part of the world, and you're looking at a map of Turkey. Turkey has produced a lot of plants that translate well into our climate. And when I was going through and just looking at plants from that part of the world, I had a list of plants and noticed that a vast majority of them were from Turkey. And I grow a lot of Turkish plants. And the first plant I'm going to show you is an acantholimon. Acantholimons look sort of like dianthus, pinks, but the foliage is very spiny and sharp. This is a plant that's not readily available. They're difficult to propagate vegetatively. The seed is only sporadically fertile. So if you look hard for them, mostly for mail order nurseries, you can find acantholimons. But they are drylanders. This is the plant in full flower. This is acantholimon venustum, which has in my opinion, the best, the brightest colored flowers. They're really a nice pink. And one of the advantages of an acantholimon, if you go to the next image, is what they look like after they flower. And the calyx at the base of the flower, when the flower dies, this papery structure beneath the flower persists on the flowering stalks. And some of the species have these bracts that are very bright white in color. In the case of Vanessum, they're kind of tan. But they make a very interesting plant even after they finish flowering. So if you have an opportunity to get an acantholyman, I certainly recommend them. Some of them get very large. I have a plant in a garden here in Pueblo that I planted in 1985 that's now probably 2.5-3 feet across. And also it shows you how long some of them can live. So very, very neat plants from Turkey. This next image, this is a... this is a plant that if I have it in my garden, people always ask what it is. And it's a plant that you primarily grow for the foliage. This is a plant called Buchanixia cubulica, which is from Pakistan. And it has this just terrific foliage. It is a biennial, which means that the first year you're going to get a rosette that looks like this image. And the second year, the plant will go into flower. And if you've had a relatively mild winter, the rosettes still look pretty good the second year. If it's a very difficult winter, sometimes the rosettes are not as decorative the second year. But you need to leave some plants so that they can reseed so that you will get more plants in your garden. But a very, very unusual and unique foliage plant. Okay, the next image, we're on number 23 now, and you're looking at a couple of plants, and the and they're both from Turkey. The blue-flowered mat is Veronica otensis, and there are a number of, there are lots of Veronica. Some of them have tall spikes of flowers that you see frequently in nurseries, like Maynard and those types of Veronicas. And then there are a number of cushion types, plant select that you heard about just a few days ago has a Turkish Veronica called Veronica liwanensis that's commonly on the market. There's another plant select one called Crystal River. And this one is otensis. Otensis is the slowest growing of the three I mentioned, and the most drought tolerant of the three. So if you are a rock gardener, you tend to gravitate toward the one that's a little more drought tolerant and a little slower grower. And one of the things that you can do with mat plants that grow in a mat is to put bulbs into them. And this particular allium is Allium caritiviens. And in flower, Allium caritiviens is only maybe at most 8 inches probably. And I have put Allium caritiviens in lots of mats of things. And obviously you'll get the best show if you can put them in a matted plant that blooms at the same time as the allium. So far, the combination I like the best is to put this allium in this Veronica. You can put it in this one or other Veronicas, but it makes a really attractive combination. And eventually, the alliums die down, and you don't even know they're there. So a really nice combination of a couple of plants from Turkey. Okay, and the next image is another Daphne. And this Daphne is from Russia. We did gravitate out of Turkey a little bit, but Daphne Julia is one of my favorites. You have, I tend to like the ones that have pink flowers, although there are a number of them that have lavender flowers. They all bloom more or less at the same time. This is another small one. It's only only going to be at most probably 8 inches tall, and could get to be a foot, foot and a half wide. Very aromatic, a really, really good plant for a rock garden, and from Russia. Okay, we're now back to Turkey. This next plant is a campanula. There are lots and lots of bell flowers. Campanula choruhensis is this one. It's very tough. It grows from a large root, and it dies down to the ground each year. This particular plant in the picture is out on the northwest end of my rock garden, where it gets full sun, very harsh in the winter. It's been growing out there, this very same plant, for, I would guess, 6-8 years maybe. Very, very hardy. The buds before they open are nice pink color, and when they open, a very nice white. There's another campanula called Trogeri. It's very similar to this plant, but the petals of the flowers reflex back, a little different look. But I think it's just a terrific campanula. Again, another plant from Turkey. This next plant, we're on number 26 now. This is a stock in a general sense. This is Matthiola montana, an early flowering plant. Matthiola, if you go out in the garden now, is flowering now. It's aromatic generally toward the end of the day or evening. One of the nice things about Matthiola montana is it is not attractive to deer and rabbits, and there are people who have grown this in their gardens and say that the critters generally steer away from it. So if you have critter issues, Matthiola montana might be a good option. Okay, again, another plant from Turkey. And I hear a beep.
Uh-oh, time to change the phone battery.
This is why we have two phones.
Yeah, okay, very good.
And this is a pelargonium. Generally speaking, pelargoniums are not hardy. And there are two that are. They're both in Turkey. This one, Pelargonium edlicarianum, and another one called Pelargonium quercetorum. Quercetorum is a much larger plant. This also is one of my favorites. It's unfortunately not readily available. It's probably your source is going to be mail order. Doesn't like to be baked. It grows from sort of a tuberous, not a root, but the leaves sort of come out of a tuber of sorts, so it has some water storage capability, I would guess, in nature. It probably goes dormant when it's really hot and dry. If you put it in too hot and dry a place in the garden, I find it also goes dormant and or dead. So for me, it does better on an eastern exposure. In flower, it's probably about a foot high and a foot wide. Not difficult to grow. So another great plant that comes out of Turkey. All right, we're going to move to South Africa now. We're on number 28, if anyone has gotten lost. And South Africa is different. If you look at the next image, which is a map of South Africa. In South Africa, we're really not looking at typical steppe. And I'm going to show you some plants that are from the Drakensberg. And if you look at the eastern side of South Africa, you'll see the Drakensberg Mountains that are labeled there. And in South Africa, the Drakensberg is the wettest part. It's quite wet in the Drakensberg. And as you move north and east, things get drier and drier until you get up to the Kalahari and real desert country. So generally speaking, if you're finding plants that are from South Africa, they're generally not very drought tolerant. The plants from the Drakensberg, which includes most of the ice plants that we find on the market, are from the Drakensberg. I'm going to show you some plants that are from another area called the Karoo. If you look at the map, you'll see the Great Karoo and the Northern Karoo. It's drier in the Karoo, and so plants from that area are going to be a little more drought tolerant. And I'm going to show you a plant from that was collected on a mountain called Snoeberg. And if you look at the map down in the southeast, you'll see Snoeberg labeled there. And the first plant is an ice plant. This is what's called Delasperma lacutu pink. It was collected high in the Drakensberg, in the East Cape Drakensberg. It's an alpine, extremely winter hardy. It forms a very dense mat. It can get in time 3, 4, 5 feet across probably. So it's a spreader. Just this neon pink in spring. Generally, it flowers mostly in spring, only sporadically after that. But if you're in a cold climate, Lesotho pink is a good selection, and it has real good winter presence. And otherwise, in the winter, it's going to look much like it does in the summer. The next ice plant is Delasperma carteri, and this was a selection called Carlisle Pink that I selected from my garden, from my rock garden. Another ice plant from the Drakensberg. This is a little one, so if you need a little ice plant, might only get a foot or so across. Slower growing, a little more delicate plant. And this next ice plant, this is this and the next two images, I'm showing you some plants that are Plant Select. Is a plant introduction program. It's a cooperative effort between the Denver Botanic Gardens and Colorado State University and the green industry. And if you heard the talk just a few days ago, you know quite a bit about Plant Select. But this is a new offering this year, one Delasperma called Fire Spinner. And it is from the East Cape, and it was collected in the mountain I mentioned to you, which is from Snoeberg. So this is an alpine ice plant, very cold hardy. It's a spreader, so you get a large mat in a relatively short period of time. And it's a very unusual flower color of orange and blue and purple. So I think people will enjoy this one. This next plant is an Osteospermum. This is Osteospermum avalanche. This was a release from Plant Select, I believe, last year. This is a very attractive composite, another plant from the Drakensberg. Nice white flowers, and the backside of the flowers are sort of a kind of a gray gold color. A very pretty plant.
And that was slide 33.
What's that?
I was just making sure everyone was on the same page. It was slide 33.
Okay. The next plant is a gazania, and most of you have probably grown gazanias. Generally speaking, they're not hardy. Plant Select has two offerings. a gazania called Colorado Gold that's proven to be remarkably hardy. This is Gazania tanager, which in a winter that's not too severe, it will overwinter. Some winters, a lot of the adult plants will die, but it always reseeds. So it's a nearly hardy, or if not a reseeding annual, but very bright. I have a garden here in Pueblo just where there are just thousands of them, and they're now blooming. The next plant you're looking at, this is a plant called Arctotis adpressa. This is a plant from the Karoo. The foliage is a really nice, shiny silver color. And in the Karoo, it forms large mats. And when we got this plant, I think we assumed that the very same thing would happen here. And it has proven to be a little difficult to grow. There have been successes, but I would guess there have been more failures with it. So it needs to be in the right place, and I'm not sure we always know what the right place is, but it's absolutely gorgeous. It's very winter hardy. Probably a plant for an eastern exposure in kind of an ordinary garden condition, but if you get a hold of it, you will be just experimenting with the rest of us. But some people have had really good luck with it, and I'm guessing that it could be that people in other parts of the country where I've sent the plant may be having spectacular luck, and I just don't know about it. Mm-hmm. But very, very nice bright white flower and gorgeous silver foliage.
I have one in my garden, Bill, and I think it's in a little bit too shady of a spot. It's east-facing, but it gets a little shade, too. And it's persisted now for at least three years, and it bloomed the first year, but not again since. And I think it's because of the sun factor. But I'm happy it survived, because now at least I can transplant it.
Well, it's they're easily movable or easily dividable. So if you can divide it up and move it around, and it could be where you are, Ava, because it's not as hot as here, that it may take more sun. But
Right.
We thought it would be easy, and it's easy in the greenhouse, but in the garden it hasn't proven to be quite so easy.
It is stunning, though.
This picture you're looking at now, or at number 36, is a succulent from South Africa, and as you get in drier parts of South Africa, and this is Rabia albopunctus from the Karoo, the plants get more drought tolerant, but also as you get in some of the drier areas, the plants may not be quite as hardy because you start to lose elevation. But this Rabias have proven to be very, very hardy in the winter, and so there's a pretty good chance that you can keep this South African succulent alive in the garden. And the next picture is an E. bracteola. This is a relatively new plant from the Karoo, E. bracteola wilmannii. And this has proven to be also very winter hardy. So this is another of these sort of half hardy South African succulents that I think you have a pretty good chance of keeping alive in the garden for a prolonged period of time. Okay, now we're going to leap into North America, and obviously there are a lot of great North American plants for a rock garden type situation and for our climate in the interior west. And this next picture I'm going to show you, Indian paintbrush. There are a number of species of Indian paintbrush. They are sporadically available in the trade. They tend to be difficult in gardens because castilleias, many of them form associations with other plants in their native landscape. And so if you buy one and just stick it in your garden, frequently you're not successful in getting it to grow. And for years I had no success with castilleias. I could grow them in the greenhouse, but when I put them in the garden, I never had any success. And I tried planting them with a number of different plants, and I finally started planting them with Artemisia frigida, the fringe sage. And in this image you're looking at now, this is Castilleja integra planted in with fringe sage. And since I started doing that, I've had all of a sudden no problems. And I even have them seeding around in the garden. And I'm surprised that all of a sudden I have Indian paintbrush. So if you find them, try to get fringe sage at the same time. Put them together, plant them, and see if you can get them going.
It makes for a stunning combination, too. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, and with fringe sage gets taller, and if you plant Castilleja integra with it, as Castilleja integra grows, that bloom stalk gets taller and taller and taller, and what's the flowers on the end of the bloom stalk are attractive, but what's underneath is not very attractive. So as the Castilleja grows up, the fringe sage grows up, and so you always see the flowers, but you don't see the somewhat unattractive stalk underneath. So it works very well with Castilleja integra. This next image, this is Castilleja sessiliflora, not as flashy as the first one, but it grows right around where I live. It grows right outside of town in Pueblo and out on the eastern plains. It's a dry lander. It grows in our dry steppe climate. I think this one probably will grow without another host plant. I can grow them in pots for a prolonged period of time, and if this particular one you're looking at is in a trough. And so I think it's less challenging to grow. And it's an interesting combination of sort of olive and pink and white. And some plants are flashier than others. This is in my trough. And this one, of course, is really flashy. And this is Castilleja cremosa, grows up in northwestern Colorado. Here again, you see it planted with the fringe sage. And this one is, I mean, it's just as bright as it can be. Their Castilleja are going to be a little hard to come by. You're looking at specialty nurseries or mail order people, but they're well worth trying to get going in a native garden or a rock garden. And there are lots of cacti. First image, we're up on number 42. This is Escobaria vivipara. This is a native of the Front Range. If you go up into the foothills, you'll find Escobaria vivipara. They make really nice clumps. The flowers are very pretty, very cold tolerant. So if you want to start with hardy cacti and you live in a cold area, Escobaria vivipara is a good one. And generally with cacti, you just provide them with full sun and good drainage, and you should be pretty successful with them. So you can start with easy ones and work up from there. This next cactus is a variety of a kind of serious Rickenbachii. This particular one comes from Kimball County, Texas, and it is one of the prettiest cacti, in my opinion. The spines are very white. The flowers are a really nice, clear pink color. And these have been in my garden out front for some time, and they seem to be perfectly winter hardy. So a gorgeous cacti, not frequently available. This is one of those that you'd have to look hard for, but I've been very successful with it. This next plant, this is an Oxytropis, and again, I'm showing you a plant that works well in a container. This is a pea family plant, Oxytropis, and plants from the genus Oxytropis and Astragalus tend to be challenging to grow. They are plants for more expert growers. A lot of them are small, and tend to pretty much be planted exclusively in a container of some sort. They're difficult in the open garden because they are moisture sensitive. They're real drylanders. And Oxytropis multiceps you'd find growing up in Wyoming. I've seen it just growing in the barrow pit off the sides of the highway. And a very small plant, only an inch or two high. And it's, depending on sun exposure, it's either been in flower or it's in flower now in my garden and my trough. So it's proven to be a very good trough plant. Better so than some of the other Oxytropis and Hysterectomus. Now I'm going to show you some penstemons. And there, as I'm sure you all are aware, there are lots and lots of penstemons. And those of us who live in the interior west, we are in penstemon country. Most of the penstemons come from the Rocky Mountain West, or not too far. This particular one is from Montana and Wyoming. Penstemon nidatus, the interesting thing about Penstemon nidatus is it flowers very early in the year. It's flowering in my garden now. And one of the things you can do with it is plant it with early flowering tulips, dwarf tulips, and it makes a really nice combination. So it's one of the earliest to flower, wants to be in not a really hot baking situation. This next penstemon you're unlikely to find anywhere. Everybody wants it because they can't find it. It grows in Utah. It's Penstemon utahensis. I grow it from seed, and I get the problem is the seed doesn't germinate very well, so there's never enough plants to do anything commercial with. But over time, I end up with a few plants, and I have some in my garden, and they're out there. They flower. They've never done particularly well. And a couple of years ago, I thought I would put one in this trough that you see in the picture. And utahensis gets a foot tall, or I've seen pictures of it much larger than that, and I thought it probably was too large to put in a trough. But I put it in there, and it's just done spectacularly well. So there's something about a trough situation that seems to suit it. And this picture, the plant is flowering now in this trough, and it's about a foot tall and extremely happy. So if you ever get a hold of Penstemon utahensis, put it in a trough. And if you look to the right of this penstemon, you see another little plant that has some little blue flowers. And frequently when people come to the house, I show them that plant and ask them if they can tell me at least what genus is in, and usually nobody comes up with an answer. But it's this little plant. This is Penstemon acaulis. And most people don't recognize it as a penstemon because it's only an inch tall or less. And Penstemon acaulis grows up in Wyoming, usually out in open fields among rubble, as you see it here. This is actually taken in nature up in Wyoming. Also, I'm showing you another penstemon that you probably are not going to find anywhere. It's difficult to propagate, and you may be able to find it if you look hard, but it's well worth finding, especially if you are a trough gardener. This next penstemon, I've only grown the last couple of years. This is Penstemon utahensis. This penstemon is... some people say a shorter variety of Penstemon hollii, which is a penstemon that grows in our mountains. I have this particular picture is in one of my rock gardens. I also have it in troughs. It grows in the Uintah Mountains in Utah. And it seems to be very growable, and I get enough plants that it's possible that you can find this through me, but I've been very impressed with it. Excellent, as I said, excellent trough specimen or in a small garden, and it's It's flowering now. If you should go out in my garden, it would look just like this. Okay, this next slide, this is a shameless advertisement for the Eriogonum Society. I'm going to show you some pictures of Eriogonums. This is a very large genus of plants, mostly western, mostly very drought-tolerant plants. And there is, if you become interested in Eriogonums, the Eriogonum Society is the place for you. And you're looking on this side. This is Eriogonum cespitosum. It's a little one in the trough. And there's almost an Eriogonum for any style of garden. But because they're drylanders, you need to be careful with water. So they really are plants that are well designed for the dry garden. And this next image you're looking at here, this is a hillside in Reno, Nevada. We were in Reno, Nevada for the Eriogonum Society conference a couple of years ago. And this is just outside Reno, Nevada. And on this one hillside, there are five different species of Eriogonum. And if any of you know Reno, Nevada, it's hot, dry, really nasty place if you're a plant. And these plants were growing just prolifically on this hillside. I'm going to show you some pictures of plants that you'd find on that hillside. This first one is Eriogonum umbellatum variety nevadense, a nice yellow one. There are a number of varieties of umbellatum, Eriogonum umbellatum, many of which have proven to be some of the better garden plants.
This is slide 51, Bill?
Yeah, 51.
Okay, thanks.
This next one is Eriogonum ochrocephalum, a little smaller. The foliage, as you go from species to species of Eriogonum, you get different foliage, different flower colors, different flower structures. There is a key to the genus Eriogonum, and if you're really serious and you want to identify Eriogonums, the key to the genus Eriogonum is somewhere over 250 pages. So it's a taxonomic challenge. It's easier just to have somebody tell you. This next one is Eriogonum strictum variety anserinum. Again, another one of the plants on this same hillside. I'm very fond of this one. It has really fluffy, nice yellow seed heads. And it has very attractive gray foliage, even though you can't see it. And this next one, this is Eriogonum robustum, a different look, very furry tomentose leaves and white to light yellow flowers. And robustum is this plant's in flowers about 6 inches tall. Most of the ones I have shown you are 6 to 8 inches tall in flower. And this next one is Eriogonum spherocephalum. Again, on this same hillside, little sort of cylindrical leaves and mustard-colored flowers. And if you ever go out and see where Eriogonums are growing, you'll have no question that they can grow without much water. They grow in really terrible, harsh locations generally. Okay, and this next Eriogonum, we're now going to a different place. We're over into California, on the up against the Sierras on the California side. And this is Eriogonum umbellatum. There are a number of different varieties or species of Eriogonum umbellatum, which tend to be pretty good garden plants. And this one is one that you more frequently will find. This is variety purpureum. And this next one, which is one of my favorites, this is an alpine. It grows, if you go up in the White Mountains in California, around Bishop, California, up to Shulman Grove, there are a lot of old bristle cones up there, and you see you see Areogonum gracilipes growing out in the open amongst this rock rubble. This is a little tiny guy, only maybe 2 inches, 3 inches tall. A good plant for a trough. Probably too small for the open garden. Okay, now I'm going to show you an Amsonia. Amsonias that grow in the dry west. They're Amsonias that grow down in the southeast and places really where there is more moisture than here, but I find that they're all extremely drought tolerant, extremely cold tolerant, very good plants for the garden. They're big ones, they're smaller ones. This is Amsonia peeblesii, which is a nice, very nice white one, and the tubes of the flowers, as you can see in this picture, are a sort of purple blue color. And Amsonia peeblesii is about a foot tall and gets maybe 10 inches or so wide. A very gorgeous one, and I'm one of those people who's inclined, if I have my choice, to pick some flower color other than white, but I like this white one. It has really nice character. And this next image, number 59, if you've been to my garden, you would know what this plant is. This is an example of a biennial. This is winter, and this is after the first year of growth. And so you have a mat, and in winter it's particularly pretty because it has this sort of reddish-purple color. And so you have a mat of these rosettes. And if you go to the next image, this is what it does in the second year. This is Epomopsis rubra. It's a plant from West Texas. And it just erupts into these spires that are 4 to 4.5 feet tall and bright red flowers. And it reseeds readily, not invasively, but it does seed around. So you have to let it go to seed or you won't have plants anymore. But makes a spectacular show. I think it's a great plant. You have to be careful where you put it, because if you think it's only going to be an inch tall and it does this, you're going to be unhappy. And then to finish, a couple pictures of Townsendias. These are Easter daisies, little dry land composites. This particular one grows just here by me in Pueblo, out just on the outskirts of town. Blooms very early. They call them Easter daisies because they're frequently blooming around Easter. Many of them are small, so this one you see in a trough. They make really good trough subjects because they're very flashy but small, and you can get up close to them. This next Townsendia, this is Townsendia Jeans Purple, one of the easiest and best of the Townsendias to put in a trough. It's little tiny. It's only going to be an inch high and a couple inches wide, but a really good performer, flowers profusely. One of the best Townsendias. Some of the Townsendias are a little more challenging to grow, but this one is easy. And this final image, I'm showing you a plant that grows up on Pikes Peak. Pikes Peak is just north of me here in Pueblo, up by Colorado Springs. You find this plant growing up in a big granite formation that they call the hoodoos. Usually it's flowering third week or first part of August. And this is Telesonics jamesii. And it's a crevice plant. It's a Heuchera relative, a saxifrage family plant, and you see it running in the crevices of these this big granite formation as one of our sort of local specialties here in the southern part of the state. So that brings us to the end of the journey. And hope you all had a pleasant trip. You've seen some plants from this country and other parts of the world that might work well here in the interior west.
That was great, Bill. Great little worldwide excursion there. It's exciting. And great eye candy, too. I just want to comment. I didn't hear you say it. You may have, but just to put it into place for people who may not have known the Areogonums. With the Areogonum Society and everything that Bill talked about are also called buckwheats. So you can file.
Some people have suggested that members of the Areogonum Society should be called buckwheaters. We're not sure that that sounds quite as the way it should.
Yeah, I might agree with that. I like Areogonum, but, you know, it helps sometimes to be able to put
buckwheat is easier.
Together. Yeah, it is. And
but you can't make pancakes out of them.
Yeah, you can't. Or you can. Not those, right?
Right.
But they are related to the one that you can, right? That's just an annual.
That's a good question. I have no idea. But obviously there are buckwheat from which you get buckwheat flour, but I actually don't know if they're related.
If I
you would hope so, since they use the same name.
I know, and often they aren't, because that's what common names do sometimes. But if I remember correctly from my studies, I want to say they are. Excuse me.
Well, let's just
related,
say they are.
But not the same genus necessarily. I'm going to say they aren't, but if you all are really interested, you should go look it up, because we aren't sure.
You can join the Areogonum Society, and someone will be able to tell you.
There you go. That's a great idea. And it was areogonum.org, right?
Areogonum.org.
Great.
Yeah, the next Areogonum conference is going to be at Steens Mountain, which is in southeast Oregon. And Steens Mountain is a very, very unique plant place. And if you're interested in plants, particularly Areogonums, although Steens Mountain, there are lots of other plants, check in to areogonum.org. And for a person who has spent most of his plant career in a greenhouse working with plants, I have started getting out in nature a little bit more, and it's very interesting to see plants out in nature that you've just been playing with in the greenhouse. It greatly expands your understanding of the plants when you actually see them in habitat. And there are lots of opportunities, relatively inexpensive opportunities, to learn about plants. The Penstemon Society, if you're interested in penstemons, and if you are here in our area around Colorado, the Penstemon Society meeting is up in Laramie, Wyoming, in June. So that's relatively close. And when you go to plant conferences, you usually have people who've scouted out the area where you're going, who will take you right to where the interesting plants are. And you not only learn a lot about plants, but you get to meet a lot of really nice, interesting people who are interested in the same thing you're interested in. So I recommend those types of trips.
Mm-hmm. I went on the North American Rock Garden Society winter study weekend a few years back in Oregon, and it was amazing for that reason. You know, we went to all these great spots, and people knew right where to take us, and because it was in Oregon and it was in the winter, it was a really nice break from our mountain winter here to get to see plants
right.
growing and blooming then. It's really great. So one last thing I wanted, two, I guess, Bill. One is, I was just wondering, we've already talked about zones and microclimates and all that, so we're well-versed in that. And then for your elevation and your location, what is the standard zone that you're recognized to be in, USDA hardiness zone?
Five or six, somewhere in that range.
Uh-huh.
This used to be zone 5. There's some people who say it has been warmer of late, so you're maybe gravitating a little bit more towards zone 6. But that puts you in the right area anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Great. That helps.
So there's so many other variables that the zone is kind of an indicator, but
right.
You know, that's moderated by a whole variety of things, as you know.
Yeah. Okay. It helps give me a frame of reference, though, for looking at your plants and what's in bloom already. and then
generally, I only sell things that are going to be hardy in my area here. And there are some things that are going to be marginal. I do a lot of things with South African succulents, many of which are hardy some winters, and always at one point or another you'll get some circumstances in the winter where it really wipes out a lot of the South African succulent stuff, and so you just replant it. It's likely not going to be permanently hardy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then I understand you do mail order from your nursery Sunscapes. So if people wanted to mail order some of these plants that you talked about, they could go to your website?
Yes, at sunscapes.net. And if you're close, it makes more sense to give me a call and come to Puebla. Plants are less expensive if you can just drive and pick them up than having me stuff them in a box and mail them off.
Sure.
So if you're close, I do take people to the greenhouse by appointment.
Great. And your phone number to arrange that or email, I'm sure, are on your website.
Yeah, it's all there.
Great. Okay, well, thank you so much, Bill, for sharing your knowledge and expertise and gorgeous pictures with us. That was a really great voyage around the world in the last hour and 15 minutes. And thank you so much once again for being with us today.
Okay, I enjoyed it.
Great. So,
yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.